Our last interview today isn't designed to put the fear of God into all of us. It's intended by the author of a new essay in the magazine Foreign Policy to be an advisory, if you like, a warning, just as we relax a bit again with COVID and New Zealand comes his admonition that we have to treat it as a dress rehearsal for the real thing. The real thing being much worse. It's possible the next pandemic could be bioengineered. The thing is that this isn't some minor prediction by someone looking for publicity. Vivek Wadhwa has a lot of it already. He's a distinguished fellow at the Harvard Law School, an adjunct professor at Carnegie Mellon's School of Engineering. He's the author of Innovating Women, The Changing Face of Technology, and Your Happiness Was Hacked, Why Tech is Winning the Battle to Control Your Brain. As an entrepreneur, he's been a Forbes magazine leader of tomorrow. Time magazine called him one of the top 40 most influential minds in tech. And he's won the Silicon Valley Forum's Visionary Award. Vivek Wadhwa, good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Lovely to have your company. Can we start with the current conspiracy theory? COVID-19 isn't the sort of mishmash of known viruses that one would expect from something designed in a lab. You say this, and it was also, I think, opined in a research report in Nature Medicine. So you're happy that this COVID is all natural, Vivek?
Yeah, because it isn't that deadly. I mean, even though it's spreading all over the world, the number of fatalities are relatively low.
The next, well, I guess we could argue about that, but I take your point, because what you're going to tell us is about a situation where the number of fatalities could be much higher. The next pandemic could be bioengineered in someone's garage using cheap and widely available technology. How would they go about that?
There are many ways of doing it. You know, for example, a few years ago, researchers at the University of Alberta in Canada took strands of DNA and were able to create a virus called horsepox. And the entire project cost about $100,000. And they were able to create something which could be turned into smallpox quite easily. Now, smallpox, you got to realize there are only two samples of it left in the world right now. One is in a secure Russian lab, and the other one is in the United States. It doesn't exist outside. Well, they demonstrated that you could actually create smallpox for a small amount of money. And it took them 6 months to do this. So now imagine if you took strands of different viruses, put them together, or you edited them using a new technology called CRISPR and turn it into something actually, you know, really lethal, which has lower survival rates, or that targets specific types of genes that are in specific populations. The scary thing is that this is possible now.
And all the world's dictators, you say, now know that pathogens can be as destructive as nuclear missiles. So that's the dark temptation, yeah?
So if you're now, an evil dictator and looking at what's the most effective way of doing damage to the world, you could engineer a virus. This is the problem. This is what terrifies me.
Can you explain CRISPR? What is the particular technology that makes it almost as easy to engineer life forms as it is to edit Microsoft Word documents, Vivek?
Yeah, about a decade ago, there were researchers at MIT and UC Berkeley who were doing simultaneous research on gene editing. Essentially, what they did was when a virus attacks our body defends itself by taking a little bit of its DNA and integrating it into our defense systems. So what they did was that they used the same technology to be able to change DNA. They essentially worked out a way of being able to reprogram a gene using the same techniques that the body uses to defend itself. That's the simplest way of describing it. It's a lot more technical than that. But in simple terms, you can now go and edit the DNA of living organisms. And it's inexpensive. So much so that in the United States, you can go on the internet and you can buy for $350 a kit that lets you start editing bacteria.
You've been told by one Chinese genomics research company that it expects to offer full human genome sequencing in supermarkets and online for $290 American by the end of this year. Even that, if that's an exaggeration, what would that mean in your view?
Well, it's already, you know, in China now, Beijing Genomics Institute, which copied a lot of sequencers from the West, is selling full genetic sequencing for $600. That's a complete human being, which means that now if you want to get a genetic sequence of any organism, it costs in the hundreds of dollars at the most, which means that now you can start putting together all the pieces to create deadly viruses. Now, we don't have samples of smallpox, but the genetic sequence may or may not be available on the web. I'm not sure about it, but you can certainly get information in research papers which tells you what's unique about smallpox or other, you know, deadly viruses, the bubonic plague, for example. You might be able to find the genetic sequence of that on the web. In my foreign policy article, I talked about being able to read DNA. We can also write DNA now. There are companies that you can send them a design for for base pairs of DNA, and they'll print it for you and they'll mail it back to you. That would cost in the tens of thousands of dollars to do something meaningful right now. But if you're an evil dictator or even a rogue scientist, tens of thousands of dollars isn't that much.
No, ribonucleic acid RNA is a molecule that can replace DNA as a carrier of genetic codes in some viruses. So you would get a little bit of that, and then you buy chemicals and enzymes, yeah? But I mean, that's enormously simplistic, but that's what you do, basically.
Exactly. And this is, literally, the kids in the United States, in fact, in many parts of the world now are doing experiments such as this. Children all over America right now are putting strands of DNA together and doing all sorts of weird experiments. Taking the gene of a firefly and injecting it into a plant, and the plant lights up at night. And, the scary thing is that the teenagers are often brighter than their parents are in hacking things. Mm. That's why we have teenage hackers who are now, doing crazy things. This is what can be done with genetic experiments also now.
But I was reading in the MIT Technology Review that companies that manufacture synthetic molecules do keep track of, and in theory, so does the US government, it's pretty tight in its control of the SARS DNA, do keep track of their customers. And MIT doesn't think we're there yet with mad people in garages. I suppose the mad person or the malign person or the evil dictator could, of course, come from one of the select laboratories that reboot viruses. Are you worried about that?
Yeah, today I'm not worried about the biohackers, because all they can do right now is play around with some bacteria and maybe make your milk go really sour. I mean, so they're not dangerous yet. I'm looking forward a few years because technology is advancing exponentially. It's governments that can do this evil right now. So this is what the problem is, that the governments have the resources to be able to create these bio labs and create bioweapons. And that's where the threat comes from today. What I had argued in my article is that we've got to build our defenses. I have a lot of people upset at me, especially the CRISPR geneticists, for publishing this and for speculating the way I did and for putting different pieces together. And I argued on Twitter that I stand behind what I wrote, because we now have a small group of people. There are a few thousand people all over the world that have godlike powers to engineer life. And there are no regulations that really stop them. Every country has some regulations, so that's not entirely accurate. But frankly, you could do crazy experiments anywhere in the world right now. And we haven't developed international conventions. We haven't developed biodefenses. People aren't even aware that this can be done.
Yes. I suppose that's the very salient point. And what they did at the University of Alberta with smallpox, someone did the same with polio. But if you were going to unleash this on the world, you would risk unleashing it on your own population. That's the obvious point to make, isn't it, Vivek? In your book, The Driver in the Driverless Car, you warned about the dangers of gene editing. You said there were going to be difficult choices ahead ethically, as with gene-edited babies. But it's all too late now, isn't it? I mean, it was always going to be all too late as soon as people realised they could do it. So what do we do legally, politically, practically, anything?
We need moratoriums on this stuff. We need to have the public be aware of what's going on, what's possible, the dangers that lie behind. I talked about pandemic from genetically engineered viruses. So I warned about these things. So now what I've said in foreign policy is that, look, the cat is out of the bag. Even if we had the governments coming together and saying, no, you can't do it, the knowledge is out there right now, you can do it. So the only thing we can do right now is to acknowledge and accept the fact that we have these new dangers and to start building the biodefenses. Here's the good news, that if you look at the Pfizer RNA-based vaccine, for example, I think it was 62 days from them getting the genetic blueprint of the coronavirus to coming up with a vaccine. we will be able to develop the antivirus capabilities within hours, literally, with AI and with fast computers and with data. Literally, we could have the virus breaking out somewhere. You get someone to sequence it immediately over there, put it on the internet, and within hours, we now have people developing vaccines. Here's what the problem is. It's in the testing of it, that this is what's going on right now. We're going through stage one, stage two, stage three trials. On that also, there are new techniques that can be done. There are labs all over the world that are experimenting with organoids, for example. This is being used in cancer treatment, where you can essentially take a copy of the tumor, replicate it in the lab, and then test medicines on it. For example, the Weiss Institute of Harvard, they've been developing human-on-a-chip technology. So you can actually test, instead of testing on animals, you can test drugs on computer chips. So we need to accelerate that technology. So there are a whole range of technologies by which you would rapidly, come up with a vaccine, test it in the lab, and then you'd have a 99% likelihood that it'll work well on humans, and then you can test it on humans, very rapidly. So we could accelerate the process of building vaccines as well. And, the beauty of this is that once we get these technologies perfected, you can now apply it to curing disease. I prepared a proposal for the Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, on curing cancer. I lost my wife to cancer last year, and it was devastating for me. I loved her. She was my soulmate, and it became my life's mission to cure cancer. So I've been working on that, and I looked at all the pieces. I talked to the top scientists, and I had the top scientists at Harvard Mayo Clinic. And I said, if we did a clinical trial with 100,000 people in India and open sourced all the data and we monitored the efficacy of the medicines and we tried a few new techniques such as ctDNA-based blood test, within 2 or 3 years, we could come up with a cure for cancer itself. So now that proposal got deferred because of the pandemic. However, the techniques I talked about are commonly available. And we could develop cures for practically every disease now using the same technologies.
It's interesting what they're doing with cancer, isn't it? The labs creating these three-dimensional cell cultures, these patient-derived organoids. So that would remove the need for laborious human trials completely, wouldn't it, eventually?
Well, yeah, I mean, that has limited usage in this case. But if you could develop other 3D models of the human being in which you could test vaccines. So it's a lot more complex than that. But I use that example to talk about what could be done for cancer. The standard method of going through clinical trials and so on, they're ancient. We have better techniques and technologies out there to cure disease already.
So COVID, which scares us so much, may point the way to solutions as well. Vivek, whoever creates a terror vaccine will have to be smart, one would think. But then more than a few scientific and medical breakthroughs have been accidental, haven't they, like penicillin and x-rays? And I suppose one worry is what emerges when you experiment without enough caution too.
So this is why we need to have the defenses ready so that as soon as an experiment goes wrong, you immediately can counteract it and develop the vaccines and do the lockdowns and everything that's needed. The good thing is we now have the ability to do it. The fact that, when the coronavirus first happened, there were people arguing all over the world that, look, it'll take 5 years, 30 years to build a vaccine, and there's no chance it can be done by the end of the year. Well, now we have about 90 companies that are vying to get their vaccines out. So within 6 months, we will have several vaccines that have been developed. Now get that 6 months down to 6 days, and you have an amazing future, because just like we're going to cure viruses, we're going to cure disease also using the same technologies.
Futurism.com online, and you get a mention here, says that the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security tested a fictional scenario in which former US politicians were asked to respond to a future pandemic situation like you describe. And the results, unfortunately, were 150 million dead in a year and the Dow Jones down by 90%. So, I mean, are we really going to be ready? I mean, there was a vaccine for smallpox, a very successful one. Will we have the solution as quickly as you say we could when that problem, heaven forbid, presents?
Well, not today. Today,
No.
like I said, we've been fumbling around. Governments have been incompetent. You're lucky to live in New Zealand because you can simply shut down flights and you're protected. I mean, in fact, I almost feel like coming and moving over there so that I'm ready for the next pandemic. So I mean, really, New Zealand is a new lucky country. Australia used to call itself the lucky country. I think New Zealand is a lucky country. I've been studying these technologies. This is what I teach. This is what I research. I hang out with the greatest scientists in the world, and I've seen the pieces coming together.
You've been in our neck of the woods. You got your first computing degree, I think, from the University of Canberra before you became a whiz kid with computer engineering at Credit Suisse First Boston. We could never have predicted then the exponential pace of change in computing savvy, Vivek. It's been off the charts, really. I mean, a new world's being created that leaves us potentially at its mercy in many ways.
Yeah, Jim, what you don't realize is that, when I was doing my education at the Canberra University, then the computers I was using were DEC machines, Burroughs machines. Those have the same computing power as today's musical greeting cards. So we're carrying, the equivalent of 50 supercomputers in our pocket today. That's how fast these things have become. Over the next 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years, the next generations of these smartphones we have will have the same computing power that a human brain does. I'm the optimist here. I mean, I'm normally very positive about humanity. I don't like writing negative articles like the one I wrote, but I fear that technology is now being used for evil before it's being used for good.
I find it interesting that this world of yours that you're describing isn't just a preserve of 20 and 30 somethings. You reckon that older entrepreneurs tend to be more successful, don't you? Why?
Yeah, because, so I used to be a tech entrepreneur. I founded two companies and then I had a heart attack and then became an academic. And I was an older entrepreneur. I started my company when I was in my late 30s and 40s, 50s. I was an entrepreneur. In Silicon Valley, the myth is that they're all young kids, college dropouts and so on. So I knew that wasn't true. So I started researching it. What I found was that when I looked at the cohort of successful entrepreneurs in America, twice as many were over 60 as under 20. Twice as many were over 50 as under 25, successful entrepreneurs. And the average age of a tech entrepreneur was 40. Now, in this little circle I have here, which shows your face, you look like you're about my age. So you're not a young kid as well. My message to you is that you can still be an entrepreneur. You can still make an impact. You can still change the world. You're never too old to innovate. You're never too old to build a world-changing startup.
Thank you, Vivek. That's encouraging. I don't know if it'll be in tech, though. I'm a bit scared of that, having listened to you. Vivek Wadhwa is with us. We hear the push now as well for avoiding expensive university education and taking up a trade like plumbing or carpentry. You argue for at least a basic university education, even if, for example, you do pursue a trade. Yeah?
Yes, because you need to keep reinventing yourself. The only constant right now is change. What we've seen with the pandemic, entire professions are being wiped out, entire industries are being wiped out while new ones are being created. So the skill that people have to really need is to be able to reinvent themselves. They need to know how to learn. And you need a bachelor's degree, you need to go through the process of learning, what's there and what's not there and getting a broader horizon. So that's why I believe that a bachelor's degree is a minimum. I don't tell my children or my students that they have to get master's or PhDs. Those are optional. If you want to be an academic, by all means, get a PhD. But, don't waste the 7 years if you want to now join industry and build, innovative things. Go and join a startup and fail in the startup and do it and learn that way. That's more valuable than an MBA. That's what I teach my students and my children. It's the same lessons I've taught them.
As you say, you are an optimist and you say this decade may have begun badly, but it'll be the most innovative in history. You still believe that?
Yes, because we have the ability to solve problems. So I believe that we'll be able to have unlimited food, unlimited energy, unlimited clean energy. We'll be able to cure disease. All of these are possible in this decade. By the end of this decade, we'll also have flying cars, which is, sounds bizarre, but the stuff out of science fiction is happening. We're going to have vertical farms in which we can grow all the food we need. I mean, we will have, and by the end of this decade, energy will be almost free because the cost of solar is dropping exponentially, as is wind and as are a few other technologies, as are storage technologies, battery storage technologies. By 2030, we'll have self-driving electric cars that can be produced for less than $10,000. And it won't make sense to have these, fossil fuel consuming vehicles on our roads anymore. This is all happening. So this is why I'm optimistic. Then you have entrepreneurs like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, who in their spare time are developing space shuttles. Elon Musk, who I've known for several years, he told me in 2012 that he planned to retire on Mars. We had been drinking. I thought he had too much to drink. But Elon is dead serious. Elon is planning to retire on Mars.
Yeah,
So
no.
this is all possible now.
Yeah, and you say that Google is changing the dynamics of cities, it's changing the dynamics of life, and that technology is enabling the world to be on the verge of solving the grand challenges of humanity, which you've just been describing. And people like me, excuse me, think, really? Because people also see all manner of dystopian futures more or less revolving around our loss of privacy and autonomy. It's never been a utopia.
I agree with you. That's why I wrote that freaking book, Driving the Driverless Car, because, it was like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in that book. Here I am talking about all the amazing things, and then they say, oh, but we could have pandemics. We're going to lose our privacy. We could have killer robots, So because the same technologies make good and evil possible. So the message I said was that if we want to create Star Trek and get this amazing future, then we got to make sure that the technology benefits everyone equally, because otherwise you're going to have inequity. You're going to have the rich eating the poor, as you saw in some science fiction movies. And we got to make sure that the rewards outweigh the risks, as with CRISPR. And CRISPR, I said, whoa, let's hold this technology back. It's too dangerous. We need to curtail it for the moment until we understand it. And then we have to make sure that we gain autonomy and not dependence. Self-driving cars are wonderful. I mean, I have a Tesla Model S that I drive on the highway here. I'm in Silicon Valley, Route 280. I put into autopilot and the car drives from one exit to the other. So I love it. The trouble is that when I'm not allowed to drive anymore, I'm going to be dependent on that self-driving car, which could be spying on me, which will follow the rules. So we lose autonomy. Is that good or bad? Well, I don't know. I mean, it's good because I can now be productive. The people who can't see well will be able to have that. These cars will be inexpensive, so even the poor will have mobility. On the other hand, we lose our autonomy. So these are the things that are happening with technology, good and evil at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, the Brave New World of Huxley was a nightmare precisely because of huge scientific advances and technology, reproductive mostly, and psychological manipulation. So in trying to smooth away the unruliness of humans, you can end up creating a benign monster, can't you?
Yeah, I mean, the trouble is that even though technology is advancing exponentially, we humans are not. Our brains haven't had a software upgrade for like 10,000 years. So we're the problem here.
I'll tell you what, though, just in closing, you keep mentioning Star Trek. And when that series began, William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy talking to one another with visual communication devices, that seemed amazing. And now we all have one.
Yeah, look at what we're doing right now. I mean, we could be watching each other, on video and be talking to 1,000 people at the same time. This is right out of science fiction. You remember those communicators that they had?
Yeah.
Those flip phones?
Yeah.
I mean, compare that to our smartphones. I mean, we'd be laughing at Spock if he landed here and he was using, a flip phone. So, at home, by the way, I have a device on which I can do my own 12-lead EKGs. I can do blood tests. I can do urine tests. I have antibody tests on it. And I get my results immediately on my smartphone.
Jay.
This is out of science fiction.
Yeah, it is.
And this is an Indian company that built this technology. So, but this is what's possible. This is why I'm saying entrepreneurs everywhere can build world-changing technologies.
I'm glad our conversation got more cheerful as it went along.
I know. I was afraid it was going to be a doom and gloom thing. And all I'm going to be talking about is the evil of the pandemic. So I'm glad you, you cheered me up over here, my friend.
We've ended on a bright note. Hey, thank you so much for giving us your valuable time.
Anytime.
Vivek Wadhwa.